This is an ABC podcast.
And welcome, beloved listeners, to LNL on RN. A little later, we'll be joined by my dear friend Barry Jones, and we'll talk about his lifelong battle to end the death penalty. But first, the ABC is hosting its inaugural Arts Week across its many platforms. And here on the Little Wireless program, we wanted to celebrate the power of art to challenge the status quo, to protest, to change hearts and minds. And it's my pleasure to be joined by three practitioners whose work does just that. Maxine Benedict-Clark is an award-winning Australian writer of Afro-Caribbean descent. Maxine's work spans poetry, essay, short stories, and children's books, which she now also illustrates. Fumba Chema, or Pilato, as he is professionally known, as a chart-topping Zambian musician and activist. He's currently working on an album which champions the voices of ordinary citizens and addresses questions like climate change and political power. And Andrea Emmerlife is an art historian, writer, and independent curator based in London. And Andrea has just recently authored a great book called A Brief History of Protest Art. So, Maxine, Pilato, Andrea, thank you for joining me. I'd like to start by learning a little more about each of you. Andrea, you first. Can you tell us where and when your absolutely marvellous obsession with art began?
So my obsession with art started really young. I think it's quite interesting because my parents weren't so into art or museums, but I found looking at the way that other artists see the world and sort of looking at paintings and looking at history through a different lens to be a quite interesting way to understand the very complicated world around me. So when I studied at the Courtauld Institute of Art, which is one of the premier places to study art history, I started to focus a lot on underrepresented narratives in art and looking at the things that art history has forgotten, but also looking at social justice and looking at the sort of bigger questions of the world that some artists seek to answer or at least fathom with. And so that's always been something that I've been interested in, trying to look and find the different pockets of art that, you know, really speaks and resonates to the world. Because I think that if art is the emotional memory of the world, we can kind of see such an incredible mirror into the whole history of humanity by looking at the way that artists have thought and protested for change and for a better future.
Now, in a recent TED talk, you said that even as a child, you were hyper aware of what you called the gaze, and you say that your parents described you as having searching eyes. Well, now, of course, you get to look for a living.
Exactly that. I think that curiosity is something very key to being an art historian or a curator. I'm very fascinated by the way that people see things and the way that history remembers things. So when I was a child, I would just be really interested into what people were looking at, what grabs people's attention, what paintings people would stand in front of for longest, and what spoke to them. And I think that at the core of that, I was just trying to understand what people find meaningful and how the world sort of interacts with thought and with ideas, how things ebb and change, how things become important. And I think art becomes a very interesting lens for that because it's so image-based that it impacts on you on an everyday basis, whether it's in a museum or in a book or on the street.
Maxine, I'm delighted to learn that you and I have something in common. We were we were bookworms. We were living in the outer suburbs of our different cities and spent oodles of time in the library.
Yes, absolutely. The library was my refuge as a kid. And, you know, I lived as the child of, you know, black British migrants of Afro-Caribbean descent in suburban Australia in the kind of 80s and 90s. You know, libraries around the place were not necessarily diverse places, but I think, you know, that idea of being able to try on another life really fascinated me from an early age, you know, that ability to just step into someone else's shoes.
Did you find yourself looking for protagonists who you could identify with?
Definitely. I think I wasn't necessarily conscious of it in the primary school years, but, you know, every time you'd come across, and, you know, this is the pre-internet age, so these days you can kind of just search up the kids' books that you want and order them. But, yeah, at the time it was kind of, you know, I remember discovering a book by a white American author, Judy Blume, called Iggy's House. And it was this book about the narrator was a young Anglo-American girl, and this black family had moved into her neighborhood. And, of course, it caused this massive unrest in the neighborhood. You know, these people are going to take over the neighborhood. And so it was her trying to grapple with understanding what was happening to this neighborhood and what that actually meant and what racism was. And I remember just, yeah, that narrative really just pulling me in.
Many, many of your contemporaries are well and truly into stand-up comedy. I like it that you're into stand-up poetry. You like spoken word poetry, don't you?
Yeah, I really gravitated towards, you know, in my post-university days, I went off and studied creative writing at university. And it was really hard at the time, and we're talking, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s, to have work, the kind of political black poetry I was writing, published in Australia. And I kind of fell into what they called at the time the slam poetry scene in Australia, which is, you know, you just kind of turn up and it's open mic poetry and you know, if it's a proper slam, people are voting on your work. And I was really taken with this idea of kind of a democratic poetry for the people, if you will.
Terrifying, absolutely terrifying. Bilotto, you were also drawn to poetry, but tell me about how you grew up in Zambia.
Thank you very much. So I was born in 1984, and when I was about 16, I lost both my parents. And society suddenly changed and how it presented itself to me. And a lot of social spaces I could not fit in these spaces. So much of what I could have said to society and to the people around me could not be said because I was not sure where I could fit in. So I spoke to myself a little more at that time. And whilst I was in that space, I wrote everything I thought, how I needed to speak to the world, what I needed to tell them, what I needed to think, what I would say in most of these situations that I found myself wanting to say something but could not say. I wrote all of that. When I grew a little older, I had them printed, and I entered a poetry contest in 2010, and it won an award as the best poetry in the country. And after that, I'd never met anyone that read or had an idea of what I'd written. So I still felt unheard. I still felt untouched. I still felt like nothing has happened until I bumped into music where I did a song that people could listen and react.
But Bilotto, I think we should explain to people listening that after the death of your parents, you had to look after your younger brother and work to pay rent and buy food while trying to go to school. At one point, you were donating blood in exchange for food.
Yes, I was staying with my younger brother because we could not stay with our relatives for one reason or the other. I was kicked out and my brother also sent out. So I started looking after my younger brother, and I could It was me to send him to school. It was me to pay rent. It was me to get the clothes for ourselves and everything that we needed. And there were times that I could walk for about 15 kilometers to the Ndola's Central Hospital to donate blood. And then after donating blood, they would give me a 1 kg of sugar and I think about 500 mils of milk and juice and a biscuit. And then I would walk back and then to share that with my younger brother. And there were times that we could just go a day without food and all of that. But there were obviously other people that were very helpful, but we could not depend on the goodness of the people all the time. But all of that generated into our understanding and perception of how society works and plays out.
Andrea, when I think of protest art, I immediately think of a painting which I regard as the towering masterpiece of the 20th century, and that's Picasso's Guernica. I know you hold that in high regard, but you date protest painting back to the French Revolution.
Yes. So when I was establishing the book, I found it very interesting to figure out what protest art means and how you can kind of encapsulate it. Because I think the idea of protest or speaking out for change is quite inherent to the human experience. So we must have been wrangling that from early on. So yes, the French Revolution and particularly the death of Marat as a painting, I think is where I start the most overtly political statement in painting. But I think also even just going back to caveman ages, the idea of impressing a mark onto something and figuring out that, you know, you want your ideas and your thoughts and your presence to mean something and to linger on in humanity is a form of protest and a form of, you know, trying to speak out and sort of imprint an idea on the world, trying to span a whole history from death of Marat onwards and sort of trying to map revolution imagely, but also looking at artists who are trying to, you know, maybe more abstractly or minimally impress ideas upon the viewer has been very interesting. So in, as well as painting, I include sculpture, installation, performance, and certain movements that are a bit more grassroots, like murals and street art as well.
All those hands on the walls of caves, it's a universal thing, and I remember writing about it years ago, saying they were the first selfies. They say, I am here, I exist. You've got a great line in the book that creating art is a civic act in at its conception, production and execution. So what do you see as the political power of art?
I think the political power of art is its sort of enduring process. Some art is obviously very smack in the face. You can see its exact meaning and its potent. And some artists describe themselves as activists. But I think in general, some even if the artist will maybe not consider themselves as overtly political, the person is political, to have an idea and put it out into the world and to envision a different world through art is one of the greatest political powers of art. And I think that there's many different levels to this political power. Obviously, within the museum, you can see incredible paintings like Guernica. But when they reach outside the museum, there's also a different level. And it's interesting because in the book, I talk about Guernica and when it was toured around for the Spanish War relief. And you start to think about art as the propaganda, but also as a method to impact on change. And then thinking about more democratic modes of art, thinking about public sculpture and thinking about public art and how, you know, if people think that art is an ivory tower, then when it's released from the museum or released from spaces, then it becomes a conquering army. I think the political power of art has yet to be fully realized. And I think that the conversations or culture wars that people try to call them are starting to make people realize just how potent and powerful looking at art can be, because it can kind of creep up on you. You might just not think that you're being, you know, being spoken to, but then you start to see the world a different way. And I think the best art does that.
Back to you, Maxine. Black protest in particular has had a long had a home in art. For example, you say many African-American gospel songs have a political element to them. Tell us more about that.
Yes, I mean, my background, you know, my parents were born in the West Indies, in Jamaica and Guyana. And so, you know, they're part of, I guess, the legacy of the transatlantic slave trade, in which millions of people were stolen from Africa, from the West African coast, and dispersed across the world, mainly to plantations. And, you know, throughout this kind of history of, I guess, the African diaspora and the dispersal of people around the world, there have been these ways in which art has assisted with basically survival. So, you know, a lot of, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I've always gravitated towards music. My dad had a massive record collection when I was growing up as a kid. And I would hear gospel music and I would think, you know, this music is just so powerful. And years ago, I kind of started researching and found, you know, all of these other historians who documented this history of, I guess, the gospel music and black hymns actually documenting things from escape from slavery. For example, the song Michael Row the Boat Ashore was actually first documented by a young university graduate who was on a boat with former slaves at the moment of freedom, was documenting them singing about this act of rowing to freedom. And if you listen to this song over time, so for example, the Harry Belafonte version from the 50s, the lyrics have been change to actually refer to what's happening in America at the time. There's this line, Mississippi, kneel and pray, another bus is on the way, referring to the bus boycotts.
I'm glad you mentioned Belafonte, because it reminds me of something I remember him saying decades ago. He pointed out that at one point the colonial British banned calypso. They saw that as subversive.
Yeah, and I think there is a lot of, you know, when you look at reggae and the history of dub poets like Linton Kwesi Johnson and Gene Binta Breeze, there's this entire generation of musicians, you know, I like to call it art by subterfuge, you know, that once you actually put a really contagious beat to something, it enables that message to just to travel further.
You've taken on the added challenge of communicating political ideas through children's books. Tell us about your book, When We Say Black Lives Matter.
Well, I mean, it was created in 2020 at the height of, I guess, Black Lives Matter protests unfolding around the world after the death of George Floyd. And the idea behind it was, you know, my family is dispersed across the world, in the Caribbean, in the UK, in Germany, in the States. And just thinking of this new generation of kids watching all of this, because we're all locked down in our homes, and feeling like, you know, they know something momentous is happening, but what does it mean? What does it mean when we say Black Lives Matter? And taking that to a younger audience and creating the space to have a conversation about it at that quiet bedtime moment where you're reading to kids, as opposed to when you're hearing this roar of the news cycle. So that was the idea behind the book, was really to open up this topic to the very youngest readers through this illustrated poem.
Back to you, Pilato. A song you put out recently is called Why. Let's just hear a bit of the track now.
Opportunity kuwapa mulu tuchinda manga bamone fi mafia full batila menshi moyo wati kuno tupusukira muya mushalo well next next chimbusu twalipata kwa madhabu ya community.
What inspired the song and what are you singing about?
So the song is about a gender inequality in the accessibility of water in most of our communities in Zambia, where you find a lot of time that the communities where human beings live, there's limited access to water. And you find countless numbers of women lining up for water to use in their houses. But again, the question is, who decides where to take this water? And how do we have a country with so many water bodies but still fail to provide this water, critical component for life? We fail to provide it, take it to where the people are, and how that produces more poverty for women than for men, because men use water for economic activities, women would spend so many hours lining up for water, and when they get this water, it's to take care of the families, take care of their homes, and how that is an acceptable reality. So the song discusses that that type of reality and asks questions, why does it have to be like this?
Another song you've released this year is called Save Zambezi. I'd like to play a little of it now. Zambezi, Samarirani, Zambezi, Sumani, Zambezi, Samarirani, Zambezi. So what is that about? What's the song about?
So Zambezi is about the river Zambezi, which is the longest river in Zambia. So in the lower Zambezi, the lower parts of the Zambezi, that's where you find the most interesting and exciting wildlife. And there are so many people and so many wildlife that survives on this water. And as you may be aware, Zambia is a mining country. So we've got mining provinces like the Copper Belt. We have got the mining provinces like the Northwestern. And in these provinces where mining is excessive, the damage to the environment is so much that it cannot be compared to the benefits that mining produces for the communities that host these mining companies. So now the High Court in Zambia gave permission to commence mining in the southern part of our country. So now what that means is that the mining activities in the southern part of our country will now affect the wildlife that exists in this region, but also lead to pollution and damaging of water and the ecosystem for the wildlife to survive, but also for the local people to access clean, fresh water.
Pilato, let me ask you this simple question. How do people get to hear your songs?
So my songs are distributed free of charge, but for specifically for this project, it's under the Betha Fellowship that I have, which is basically a conversation around water, and I get to share this music freely on my social media and radio, community radio stations, so they get to access it via internet and just community radio stations.
Now, you've seen your songs bring about change in your country before, haven't you?
Yes, yes. So I've been doing music for 9 years now. And within this period, my music has been instrumental in mobilizing young people to question, to hold government to account. And I would give a practical example. I think it should be in 2013 when a song that I did with a friend of mine pushed the government to start is constructing roads in the country after it was clear that they were not intending to do so, even after they had promised. And just the previous election, my music and part of my work as an activist was very instrumental in mobilizing young people to vote for a new government. So it's evidently a critical part of our democracy composition.
I must say, we needed you in Australia from recent years. Back to you, Andrea. Your work also challenges the status quo of the art world. Tell me how you are trying to change who typically gets depicted and how they're depicted in art.
There's many different ways to tackle this sort of the idea of representation. With my exhibitions, the exhibitions that I curate, I seek to sort of look through history and look at the artists that art history has forgotten or different narratives that art history has perhaps overlooked. So my last exhibition called Black Venus, which is on it till the end of August at Fotografiska in New York, I sought to create and to forge a history of the Black woman in visual culture, starting with figures such as Hottentot Venus all the way through to Josephine Baker, looking at the different unknown sitters of European painters in the 18th, 19th, 20th century, and then moving to the contemporary. And I've done this. This was a very exciting and beautiful exhibition because it sought to create a show that I wish I could have seen, but also prove that these shows are exciting and worthy of academia and of research, because there's not a lot of precedent for these narratives. So with creating exhibitions that forge new ways of looking, but also forge new little art histories, and hopefully do attention to widen the way that we see art history and call for more expansive art history, I seek to sort of change the way that people look at art, but also look at people and look at the world.
You made a point
in real time as well.
You made a point in a TED talk recently that it's easier to find out about gardens in the 17th and 19th century paintings than it is to look into the history of black women in art. Maxine, do you think we're starting to see a shift in the diversity of literary works that we're seeing in Australia?
I think definitely. You know, I think for me, it would have been almost unthinkable to have a work like When We Say Black Lives Matter, or even my other first picture book, The Patchwork Bike, published in Australia 30 years ago. You know, the idea of it being on a shelf at that time, I think would have been kind of, you know, almost shocking. And I think that Australia is taking its cue, as we tend to do because of cultural cringe sometimes, from the United States, from the UK. You know, definitely in Black History Month, for example, when my book pops up in displays in the States, it's kind of part of a whole slate of new authors who are up and coming, who are writing, creating strong Black work. And I think it's really important to pick up on something that Andrea said, that idea of putting art into spaces where it wouldn't necessarily normally be seen changes the narrative. So, you know, that idea that picture books really are the first form of art, and sometimes the only form of art that we're sharing with young people, I think the narrative is starting to change.
So we've talked about the power of art, but there's also the power of censorship, and there's a lot of that around. Maxine, your personal experience of this, I understand your children's book, The Patchwork Bike, was pulled away from first graders in Texas. Congratulations.
Yeah, that was a surprise, that one. So The Patchwork Bike really is a narrative about these kids and this, you know, living in this village on the African continent, and this bike they love that's essentially made from recycled materials that they found about the place. But the illustrations are done by a street artist named Vanti Rudd, who I'd sought out specifically because he was a street artist and does these incredible political murals. And so he embedded this work with all of this incredible political imagery, one of which is these two kids dancing on the top of an abandoned police car. So this book was given, I believe, to the entirety of first grade. It won quite a big award in the States called the Boston Globe Horn Prize Award for Best Picture Book. And so it was given to the entirety of first grade, one of whom took it home, and there was a police officer in the family who took objection to this. And these poor kids had their book confiscated, and then the school had to issue an apology to the families.
Maxine, you really are a troublemaker. Now, Pilato, there have been many attempts to censor you, of course. You've had death threats, you've been arrested, been forced into exile. So what are your thoughts on the dangers of trying to silence art and artists?
I think the dangers are major, because what artists do is present a reality or is a perspective that may not be seen, may not be accessible to so many of our members of society. But some of these perspectives may challenge our norms. Some of these perspectives may provide an alternative view to reality, to the reality that we are familiar with. Silencing that perspective, silencing the artist, does not take away the existence of an issue that they are pointing to. If you silence an artist, if you censor them, if you manage to stop them from expressing that view or that idea that they have, you've not taken away the problem. What you've done is you've just blindfolded yourselves. You've decided not to see what exists. And most of these social ills will accumulate and erupt at some point.
Absolutely agree with you. Absolutely.
The effects may be worse.
Andrea, despite the fact that the UK and Australia are trying to place limits on the right to protest, which we recently talked about with George Monbiot, there are some good things happening in the UK in this area. Tell us about the commission you've been appointed to looking into London's public art.
So, yes, that's an incredibly exciting initiative. And it's perfect because I talk and I sort of reckon and theorize a lot about what a future art world might look like. And this is the type of setup that can help enact that change. So the commission was founded by Sadiq Khan, who's our mayor of London. And it's a setup of a committee of us who are looking at how we can diversify the art that we see on the streets. London is such a multicultural place. There's so many different people from different countries, different cultures. And it would be a shame if when you walked through the streets, it didn't reflect that. So how do we find ways to make our monuments, our public art, reflect the different peoples and ideas that live within it? So we're looking, to commission works, to look at what's already there and sort of look at how we can create a London that reflects that, knowing that what we see every day impacts on how we see people and the world around us.
It's time for me to thank the three of you for coming on and being, well, so inspiring. I've been talking to Maxine Benaba-Clark, who's an author and poet, Pilato, a Zambian musician and activist, and Andrea Emelive, an art historian and curator, and her new book is A Brief History of Protest Art, published here by Thames and Hudson. LNL on RN, and let's go out by hearing a bit of Mama Earth from Pilato's album Here I Live.
Climate change, we the change, both the high and the low need to know. If we all say no to the cutting of trees, then we're giving more life to Mama Earth, to Mama Earth, to Mama Earth. Then we're giving more life to Mama Earth, to Mama Earth.
Barry Owen Jones has much to be proud of in his decades of public life. So many good causes fought, many of them won. I know the one of which he is most proud is his leading role in the crusade against capital punishment. Now, let me admit to the simple fact that Barry is my oldest friend, not only because of his remarkable years as he nudges 90, but also because of its duration. And it began, oddly enough, not long before the execution of Ronald Ryan. In 1967, the last execution occurred in Australia. Ronald Ryan was hung at Pentridge Prison in Melbourne. I remember it as if it were yesterday. Now, at the time, Barry published a compilation of essays on capital punishment, significant thinkers, in one compendium discussing the most extreme form of human punishment. It was called The Penalty is Death, and it featured the views of the good and the great, Charles Dickens, for example, Camus, Koestler, legal scholars such as Cesar Beccaria, and rigid enforcers like the horrible J. Edgar Hoover. Now, 5 decades of abolitionist advocacy later, Barry has created a revised edition of the book, and it's published by Scribe. Barry, welcome back, and congratulations, and thanks for coming on, because I know you're in the middle of being sorely afflicted by COVID.
Yes, I was deeply annoyed. I was supposed to be going to Brisbane on the 1st of August, because that was the centenary of the abolition of the death penalty in Queensland. And that was one of the reasons that the new edition came out 54 years after the original book. And in the end, what happened was I participated by Zoom. They had Terry O'Brien, the great Julian McMahon, QC, who was the person who pro bono acted for Sukumaran and Chan, and yours truly, and I was there as a ghostly presence. It's amazing that Queensland was the first jurisdiction in the entire British Empire to abolish the death penalty. See, they did it back in 1922, but they'd made an earlier attempt in 1916.
I remember that the campaign to save Ronald Ryan, the unsuccessful campaign, recruited a lot of young people to activism, probably second only to the Vietnam War.
Oh, there's no doubt it's a great life changer. It was not necessarily a popular issue at the time. I mean, after all, Henry Bolte, after the execution of Ryan in February 1967, he won the election of that year, and he won the following election. But nevertheless, you had people like Steve Brax as a good example, Jim Bacon, the former Tasmanian premier. That changed their whole political lives. So in other words, you can have an issue that's not necessarily a popular issue judged by, you know, opinion polling. But in fact, if it changes people's attitudes and that change goes on for decade after decade after decade, it makes it very significant.
First Nations people here had a strict code of punishment or strict codes of punishment, some of which may have resulted in death. But you write that execution as a ritual begins here with European intervention, and you cite hangings on the Batavia.
Not on the Batavia, but as a result of the wrecking and what happened to the sinking of the Batavia on the Houtman Abrolhos Islands, which is just off Western Australia. There were seven hangings on dry land in October 1629. They're the first of 2,140 executions, of which we know for certain of named victims. How many Indigenous people were killed informally, were executed informally by brutal treatment at the early times of settlement? It's very difficult to estimate. It could be a roughly equivalent figure.
Okay, now let us face the simple fact that the death penalty is inextricably linked with, imperialism, colonialism and Christianity.
Absolutely. It's quite central to it. And in fact, some of my fundamentalist relatives down at Geelong used to say, well, if you hadn't had the death penalty, you wouldn't have Christianity at all. So they saw that as being a great boost. One of my great heroes is the great French essayist Montaigne. Montaigne, you know, is a contemporary of Shakespeare. And he, in those wonderful essays of his, he's constantly trying to work out what are the things he can be certain about. Is he confident about any opinion to be able to make a completely dogmatic judgment on something that's irreversible? And of course, because he was a magistrate, he probably would have had the power of life and death in various things. But when he started to examine the way in which his mind works, he said, look, I looked at what I wrote yesterday and I can see that it's ridiculous. And tomorrow, if I look at something else, I'll see that what I wrote the day before was wrong as well. So he was always convinced that you could never really say, this is it. I'm making a judgment. It's infallible. It's irrefutable. It's irreversible. And there's nothing you can do about it. In fact, of course, his mind was changing all the time. And in particular, in areas like heresy, as he said memorably, it puts a very high value on your beliefs to roast a man alive because he has a different one. One of the great figures is Cesare Beccaria. Beccaria was a real genius and one of the great Enlightenment figures, not a well-known name here, but he wrote this book called On Crime and Punishment. It's a familiar sound. On Crime and Punishment in 1764, published anonymously with a preface by Voltaire. And in fact, because it was regarded as anonymous, there were a lot of people who thought that Voltaire had actually written it. But it was this 26-year-old economist. And he just said, look, the purpose of punishment, it's not divine vengeance. We're not acting as the agents of the Lord. We're looking for a rational outcome. If you've got a problem, how do you solve it? If you want to keep crime rates down, what are the best ways of doing it? And he said, well, it's obviously certainty of detection and a high probability of conviction. And that book that he wrote is so powerfully argued that it was taken up by some of the enlightened despots. And it's hard to believe that Tuscany, for example, abolished the death penalty as early as 1786. Austria, Joseph II, who I did my master's thesis on, he abolished the death penalty in 1787. I mean, that's just in the same decade that the first fleet came out to Australia and had their first hanging within a fortnight of arriving.
I note that you quoted Tolstoy in that 1975 speech to the Victorian Parliament. Why Count Leo?
Well, it's the most extraordinary piece of writing where he was in France and he saw an execution in 1857, and it was an image that haunted him all his life. And he said, I've witnessed many atrocities in the war and in the Caucasus, but I should have been less sickened to see a man torn to pieces before my eyes than I was by this perfected, elegant machine by means of which a strong, clean, healthy man was killed in an instant. In the first case, there's no reasoning will, but a paroxysm of human passion. In the second, coolness to the point of refinement, homicide with comfort, nothing big. When I saw the head part from the body and each of them fall separately into a box with a thud, I understood, not in my mind, but with my whole being, that no rational doctrine of progress could justify that act, and that if every man now living in the world and every man who had lived since the beginning of time were to maintain in the name of some theory or other that this execution was indispensable, I would still know it was not indispensable, that it was wrong. That's pretty good writing.
It absolutely is. Beloved listeners, I'm talking to Barry Owen Jones on LNL, on RN, and our topic is the death penalty. It took until the mid-80s for de facto abolition to become, well, wide in this country.
Well, the extraordinary thing was the latest of the states to actually abolish the death penalty was New South Wales, of all things. New South Wales abolished the death penalty for murder comparatively early, much earlier than Victoria, but it seems simply by an oversight, they'd forgotten to cut it out of the Crimes Act, but it looks as if the parliamentary draftsperson must have dozed off and didn't notice that it had been retained in their hat. So it was a kind of an absurdity, but of course it didn't mean anything, because the last execution in New South Wales was actually 1939.
Let's head to PNG, where the statistics during colonial rule are elusive, but your book reminds us that there may have been 60 hangings until they ceased in 1954. Now, this is an important chapter in the history of the death penalty here.
First, I thought the figure was 60, and then years ago, in the 70s, I started doing work on the National Archives, and I realised the figures were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it meant that back in 1943-44, the AIF decided to embark on a series of executions, and the total number of Papua New Guineans who were involved is probably about 150. Hard to get the precise figure because the records in the National Archive have been gutted. The point that's so extraordinary about what the army was doing was that there's no record about what the trials were like. I mean, did the accused have the benefit of counsel? What languages were they conducted in? Did the judges understand local indigenous languages? Did they have the right of appeal? None of this is clear. And then, to make it worse, they decided not to tell the government in Canberra what they were doing.
Now, when Curtin found out, he stopped it, didn't he?
He stopped it. But the most extraordinary thing was still to come. The general officer commanding ordered a whole series of other trials in 1945, really within weeks of the end of the war. There's no question about Papua New Guinea began under challenge then. He wanted to execute Sir Vernon Sturdee, who was the GOC, in July 1945, and the war ended in August. He wanted to execute about 50 Papua New Guineans. And so he sought legal advice from somebody called Brigadier Alan Lloyd, who was later a judge in New South Wales, but who was the director of Army Legal Services. And he said, in effect, look, I'm the commander-in-chief. Do I have to obey these clowns in Canberra who've told me not to go ahead? And there's a wonderful reply, which mercifully has been preserved in the archives, where Lloyd wrote back and said, well, strictly speaking, if you think of the terms of engagement you've got, you may have absolute power, and perhaps you can do whatever you want. But he said, a reading of history suggests a certain caution, because the consequences of acting against the civilian government back home might not be happy, because cabinet enforces compliance by removing from office any public servant who flouts his instructions. But the bizarre thing is that you've got a general who's wanting to go ahead in defiance of what the Canberra government is doing. What was in their heads?
Let's head to the US. Once again, it seems only yesterday in this case, there's George W. Bush as the governor of Texas, authorizing, as I recall, over 100 executions during his tenure. These days, the death penalty has been abolished in 23 states, but it's retained in 27. Can you explain that?
No, I'd qualify that figure. I'd say you've actually got 23 abolitionists. You've got four in which there's a long-term moratorium. California, for example, the biggest of all the states, has not abolished the death penalty, but they haven't had an execution for decade after decade, because the last time they had a referendum on the subject, the referendum maintained the death penalty. So you've got four states, Pennsylvania, Ohio, California, and there's one other I've just forgotten, where you've got a long-term moratorium, but where the death penalty is not actually abolished. So it's actually 23, 23, 4.
But the 23 retention states are all in the Old South, aren't they?
Yes, without exception. There's no doubt that it's related to lynch law, it's related to slavery, and it's related to religious fundamentalism. That's the other thing that's very closely associated with and very disturbing.
This is a Christian fundamentalism that opposes abortion but endorses hanging.
Incidentally, I was going to say two of the great things in the book that I strongly commend people. One is an introduction by Richard Burke. And Richard Burke is an Australian barrister, expat, now living in the southern states of the US, living in Louisiana, who's working entirely on death penalty issues. And his introduction is stunning. And there's a wonderful introduction by Julian McMahon, and a third one by Michael Kirby, who, of course, has devoted years and years and years internationally to working against the death penalty.
How's it playing out internationally at the moment? I know that China leads the field by orders of magnitude.
Well, China's very bad. Egypt is particularly bad. Iran is probably the second worst after China. And in fact, on a pro rata basis, Iran is actually ahead of anyone. Iraq is terrible. Our ally, Iraq. Saudi Arabia is very bad. On the other hand, there's good news in Malaysia, which is moving in the right direction. But Singapore, after having some years of moratorium, is now moving back. And that's, again, you've got that authoritarian streak that's very significant.
That's also, of course, recently happened in Burma. We reported on that story.
Burma's situation is appalling beyond belief. They haven't had an execution since 1989, at least not a formal execution since 1989. And now they've got four for what are just political crimes, just exercise of the power of state.
Barry, campaigners for abolition have to be prepared to argue some pretty tough cases. I'm thinking of the appalling Julius Streicher, Eichmann, of course, and Saddam Hussein. It gets a tricky case to make.
Of course it's difficult, but part of the problem is this. I think that in another way, if you think of Julius Streicher being directly, indirectly responsible, let's say for a million murders under the most horrific circumstances, and what happens is he's hanged by the neck until he is dead. Ronald Ryan is caught, fires a shot, I'm certain had no intention of killing, but it was really intended to, you know, frighten off the warder, but it came at just the wrong angle. It did kill him. He's executed. And somehow, Stryker's crime and Ryan's crime are equated because the penalty is identical. It doesn't make any sense at all.
I found it very hard to argue against the execution of Eichmann. I still find it absolutely wrong because you've got to take, in a sense, an absolutist position on the death penalty or it's meaningless.
That's true. That's the toughest thing of all. But you've got to do it. Obviously, a character like Ambrosi is an obvious hate figure from an Australian point of view because of his involvement with the Bali bombing. But you do have to take that absolute case. You can't have exceptions. And the point is, you've either got to be committed to rationality and to humanity and bringing out the best in what human beings are all about, to realise what we're capable of.
I can remember you and I discussing capital punishment as a deterrent, oh, a lifetime ago. And as I recall, you made the point that many people who were hanged in England had themselves witnessed public executions in the past.
Oh, well, there's no question that back in the days of public executions, that the overwhelming majority of people who had been executed had seen at least one or more executions. And it's quite extraordinary. But of course, what often is forgotten is that murder in many ways is, in some ways, of all crimes, the one that's perhaps more likely to be done by non-criminals altogether. You know, something happens that gets a family dispute. You just go mad over something. You hadn't thought of killing somebody, but you get the gun out and you see your neighbour and you've overcome with such rage that you shoot away. And yet you wouldn't dream of stealing from them. Murder's a quite extraordinary, quite anomalous kind of crime.
And, of course, they are so frequently botched in the execution of the execution. I'm thinking of all the horror stories that come out of the US.
Absolutely. The most important issue of all is to realise that you've got to look at the evidence. You've got to examine this from the point of view of a dispassionate point of view.
I've been talking to the Honourable Barry Jones, AC, on his compilation of essays about the death penalty. The republished edition of The Penalty is Death is out via Scribe. And that, beloved listeners, is your lot for the week. Thanks to the team, E.P. Anna Whitfeld, Catherine Zengerer, Anne Arnold, Taryn Priadko, Joey Watson, and sound engineer this week, Simon Branthwaite. We'll be back, God willing, next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.